Roger Henderson is the author of Nomad Capitalist, How to Reclaim Your Freedom with Offshore Bank Accounts, Dual Citizenship, Foreign Companies, and Overseas Investments. While American-born, he has lived all over the world and holds fast to a simple motto, go where you're treated best. We sat down in late July and discussed global entrepreneurship, life on the road, travel, authoritarian creep, and a whole host of other topics. If you're an entrepreneur looking to learn more about expanding your passport and residency portfolio, limiting your tax burden, and living in places that will roll out a red carpet for you, reach out to me and I'll put you in touch with the good people at Nomad Capitalist. Happy listening, and as always, stay wild. Andrew, thanks so much for coming on to 27 Rish.
Hey, thank you.
I start off most of my interviews with this question, so you're going to be no exception, and then we can get into some of the more fun and spicy stuff.
I always like to be the exception, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, you know, maybe your answer will differentiate you.
All right.
Who is Andrew Henderson?
The word that always comes to my mind is entrepreneur. I've wanted to do it since I'm 12 years old. I've been doing it since I'm 19 years old and hopefully improving at it over the last close to 20 years. And I think that defines me. It defines where my mind goes on these issues. I think that for me, business and the business that I run, whatever business it might be, is really what defines me. I think that as a man, it is your drive, your ambition, your fortitude, your stick-to-itiveness in figuring things out that defines you. And it's something that a lot of people don't understand because they think once you have a certain amount of money, that should be enough, and that was the goal in the first place. And to some extent, lifestyle was a goal. Freedom was a goal. But I define myself as someone who wants to be in business, who wants to solve problems. And that's the first thing that always comes to my mind. Whenever we discuss any problem, it's like, well, in business, this is that. And they're like, well, we're just talking about you. So I define myself that way.
Interesting. I think I would probably define myself along similar lines. I think it's partially the American in me, or maybe the American in us, but self-creation and self-invention comes to mind. You know, the idea of having to really think carefully about who you are and who you want to be. And for me, that's somebody who makes things and builds things. And, you know, the medium I've chosen for that is creative storytelling. But interesting, I wasn't necessarily expecting that. But it's cool to see how people take these questions in different ways. So
you could say, oh, citizen of the world, world traveler. I mean, to me, that's sure, almost kind of baked into the pie, right? So the nomad capitalist is a guy who travels, just got back from somewhere yesterday. He's a global citizen. I mean, to me, that should be the default.
Right.
Right. I mean, like, oh, I'm a patriot for a country. I don't know anything about any other countries other than they're all bad.
Yeah.
that to me isn't that's not normal. So I think, like, you know, moving around the world as a human being is normal and not particularly noteworthy. And that's why I would say entrepreneur.
No, absolutely. I remember when I was I must have been like 17. I read this book, Vagabonding, by a guy named Rolf Potts. And it was the full title was Vagabonding, an uncommon guide to the art of long-term world travel. I was a teenager and I read that and it changed my life. And I've been doing that more or less ever since. And so I totally agree that there's this sort of myopic vision that what we have here is not just the best in America, is not just the best, but it's the only, you know, like there's all those other people out there. It's funny how, like, when you watch a movie, some, you know, Western or whatever, the second you go into Mexico, like it turns into sepia. And it's like us and then everyone else. But I guess, okay, the first question on the subject of America is a bit of background. I'm like I was, I guess I still am, a journalist. I think about this stuff a lot. And one thing that, the magazine I was working for before was called Quillette, that we were chronicling, was a lot of the sort of sickness in America. And what I've come to see America as, frankly, now is sort of the state that America is in is similar to the state that I think Rome was in right before it fell. I think there's a great deal of rot and decline in lots of institutions across in various aspects of American life, in our schools, you know, public schooling, K through 12, in our colleges, higher education, in politics, federal agencies becoming politicized, journalism as an institution simply just not being trusted by people, a lot of factionalism in the entertainment industry, and companies making just sort of bad decisions. You know, I see just a lot of inefficiency over and overregulation, and things that inhibit progress that absolutely don't have to be. And it's tragic because there's this line from Don't Look Up. I love that movie. It's an Adam McKay film where right before the world is blown to smithereens, he says, "We had it all, didn't we?" And I see in America, like, we don't need to get into too much political nitty gritty here, but I just see that we have a good thing, and yet we can't help ourselves from bungling it. And so, you know, you've talked about this fight or flight question. I've chosen to fight. I make my contributions from a distance, but I left the United States a long time ago. So I don't know. When you look at the state of American affairs today, how do you see this kind of sickness?
Well, I think that empires never last, and there's always an increasing sickness towards the end because people don't want to admit it doesn't last. People think, and this is exhibited by everything. You know, hey, do you want to move to this country? Do you want to move to that country? No. You know, the stuff that happens there can't happen here. You point out, hey, there's riots in France. That's not so dissimilar of a country. Hey, they have this in Canada, or they're doing this in New Zealand, or Australia isn't letting in their own citizens during a health crisis.
Yeah.
Like your own citizens. Like that's the law.
I know. I was there. I was in Australia.
And so it's like, oh, well, that couldn't happen here. I mean, like, really? Like your country, they figured it out now. You know, something in the United States. I mean, there's still a great entrepreneurial spirit, and you still have people going to the U.S. and starting businesses, but they are 1 or 2%, and that's bit. I mean, it's been accepted long enough in the U.S.'s history that those, you know, couple percentage points of innovators were respected and they did great things. They're not respected anymore. And you just watch any of the news. I mean, I was watching something last night. Why don't we take the cap off the Social Security tax? That means if you make $100 million this year, you should pay, if you're self-employed, like $12.5 million into Social Security. But it's a benefits plan. You'll get the benefit back. You're going to get $12.5 million out of Social Security. Of course you're not. But then they're like, well, but wouldn't it be nice for all the other people? And wouldn't my parents like an extra $200 a month? Like, that would be nice. They could go out and enjoy themselves a little more often. And it's just like there's no respect for those people anymore. And so I think once that respect goes, the country goes into sickness. So if you tie it back to my view in the world, which is entrepreneurship creates opportunity, creates jobs, makes societies better, innovative societies thrive. I mean, some of the most innovative societies in the world right now, look at the Middle East, look at the Gulf, look at places like the UAE. The ministers they have of their government actually have experience. Some of them are highly successful former business people who actually know what they're doing in terms of the economy or finance or aerospace or, you know, whatever else. In the US and the UK and those countries, they hire political flacks. Who do you think is gonna last longer? And so I that's the sickness. Now, perhaps they could go on for a while. And so the prevailing wisdom is, well, who's gonna overtake us? A lot of little places, you know, people in our business, the global citizenship, the offshore business, one of the big places is Singapore. They did a lot of things right, at least as an asset haven. Maybe you don't want to move there, but asset haven, investment place, Singapore's up there. You're going to see so many mini Singapores, and I've been saying this for 10 years, in the same way that you're seeing the dollar slowly but surely lose global reserve currency status, one percentage point at a time. And those one percentage points, they're not going to one currency. They're not going to the euro. They're not going to the... But, you know, the yen went from 3.5% to 5.5%.
Yeah.
Other currencies are adding a percentage point, you know. So the same thing's going to happen. People like myself left the United States and went to any... Like, not very many of us went to Malaysia.
Yeah.
But a few did. And if you went over here and to Thailand and this and that, and there's bigger pockets and smaller pockets. But when you start taking away at the margins, that's when countries fail. And so the overall picture is the sickness is work isn't valued. People who produce things that are innovative are told some very nasty things. They're not really wanted. They're just there to be milk cows, as Doug Casey would say. Give us more so my parents can go out to the Sizzler once or twice a month with the extra Social Security money. You need to pay millions. They're like, that's the sickness. And you see it in all the rankings of freedom, of economy, of everything. The U.S. has been going down since I've been looking at it for the last 25 years.
I think, I mean, you've talked about this, the turning on the productive class. Like when you take the productive class and you piss them off, they're going to leave. Are they going to relocate? Are they going to say,
no, where else are you going to go? They say, right? Where else are you going to go?
See, I think that's interesting because I lived in Australia from 2020, right before, like through most of COVID, from 2020 to 2022. And I saw a lot of the craziness. I mean, really crazy stuff that we could. And I try not to, you know, Hanlon's Law, try not to attribute to malice what could reasonably be explained by incompetence. But there was some very unsettling things going on. I mean, you couldn't cross state borders. There were, you know, guys with guns, like army guys at the border. I tried to cross a few times. The car was turned around. We had all the passes. We had everything we need to do. We'd followed the rules and yet, you know, turn around. A lot of discombobulation, people getting $5,000 fines in the street for being in a group of one too many people. Of you're with three people instead of two. There was one funny case of a guy with you were allowed to exercise, but he was eating a kebab. So they determined he, in fact, was not exercising, and they gave him some crazy ticket. But look, I mean, I wanted to rehash or relitigate the whole craziness of Australian COVID policies. But there's this idea that, okay, where else are you going to go? You're going to leave Australia? You're going to leave the United States? You're going to leave Canada? You're going to leave, you know, you're going to leave the UK? Where are you going to go? In fact, there are a number of countries, as you and the good people at Nomad Capitalist point out, that roll out the red carpet for people and say, hey, you want to come here? You want to work? You want to not be, you know, taxed to fucking smithereens? And we'll just leave you alone and let you continue contributing to our economy and to the global economy? Fine. Come here. We'll take care of you. So, you know, and yet we have policymakers in the United States or the UK or Canada, whatever, who believe they're never going to leave. And I think the reason for this is I was talking to a friend at a very large American company the other day, and he was lamenting some of the weird policies, diversity, equity, inclusion policies that were being put into place that just kind of didn't make any sense. And he was saying that he likened this to the captain of the Titanic turning the steering wheel all the way to the right. And the Titanic, you know, it's a big fucking ship. It takes a long time to turn. You don't see the effects down the line. And there's this line of thinking that we have growth, we have prosperity, we have this big ship now. nothing can ever happen to it. The people aren't going to leave, right? When in fact, the Titanic is turning. We just don't, we don't see it. And then, you know, eventually it hits an iceberg. But people like you have left the United States. They've said, you said, where are you going to go? And you said, watch me. There's plenty of places I could go.
And then they get angry when you go. But they don't know what they want. But you make a very interesting point. For me as an entrepreneur, I go back to that definition. The worst thing you can do is to think you're infallible. In fact, on the contrary, one of the best things I've ever done is I don't have the highest opinion of myself. I look at my successes as somewhat trivial. I somewhat brush them off. And I look at, you know, how do I solve the failures? And I wake up every day and say, okay, here, you know, what's not working? Now, you can paralyze yourself too much with that by saying, well, I'm afraid to fail. That's a problem. And I think one of the biggest failures of entrepreneurs and of people is they haven't failed enough. And if I look at countries where people make less money, part of it is they're so afraid to fail because in their culture, failure is the end. Whereas in places like the US or Iceland, historically, very high income cultures, failure is, all right, cool. What did you learn? Move on to the next thing. So natively much more intelligent people, I think, in some countries don't do as well for that, among other reasons. And so that is one good thing about Western culture. But again, it's really changing. I live all over the world. We've hired for our company all over the world. We don't need a DEI person to work here. We just have actual diversity organically because I believe that. We didn't have to go out and find it. I just said, where are the best people? And it turns out they're all over the place.
Yeah.
And I think that, a lot of sickness, to use your word, in a country like the United States. And I'm sure, you know, I think generally most of the big English speaking countries probably follow. I think Australia is kind of the same. And if you think that what Australia would have done to you in, you know, a year or two or 3 years ago, that somehow there won't be another situation where they'll do it again, that's the area where I think that people who see the sickness, where they're wrong, is, okay, we got, I mean, like, we, the only people we had calling us during COVID, I want a passport, I want a plan B, during the truckers protest in Canada. Whenever these things start to cool down, people are like, oh, okay, it's not so bad, best country in the world again.
Yeah.
Wait, if your husband comes into the room with a knife and starts running around chasing you when he's drunk one night, you don't let him sleep it off and be like, well, I'm sure that'll never happen again. No, you pack up your stuff and you leave because God only knows what's going to happen the next time. And I really view living in this as an abusive relationship. Listen, I've got an ex-consular officer who came out recently and publicly like, I think what you do is terrible and you're an exploitative person and how you buy citizenships and this. A guy whose entire salaries in his life has been funded by taking people's tax dollars at a point of a gun thinks I'm, by the way, not even on topic because I was talking about getting a citizenship from a country where my ancestors are from that doesn't require money. It's just as a birth. Ultimately, I didn't qualify. And he said, I'm very, very happy that you were unhappy. That's a guy who works in the U.S. government. He said, oh, it's the comments right there. By the way, his full name, you can look him up. Okay, don't do that. But he's not hiding who he is. He's very happy as a diplomat to come out and say it. And so it kind of cements the point that for me, the U.S., living in the U.S. was an abusive relationship. It was abusive for me growing up there. But the government is abusive to its people. And when you try and leave peacefully, I went and gave up my citizenship. I was very nice. And they were very nice, by the way. And I've said that from day one. They were very kind, actually. The woman who handled it was downright kind. Mm-hmm. So I'm not trying to say everyone who works at the embassy, they were kind to me. Very professional, very efficient. It's not their fault. I have to pay an extortion fee to get out. But they were kind. But I left. And I said, okay, you know what? I feel better about the United States now that I'm no longer, you know, part of it as a citizen. And let's let them do their own thing and I'll do my thing. And then like any abusive relationship, various people, including this guy, come and chase after me and tell me I'm terrible. It's like, dude, I left. because I don't want to be in a fight with you anymore. I just want to move on with my life in peace. But they are abusers. And this is what abusers do. And to anyone who thinks that abusers are going to stop being abusive because they did it once and it's over, is wrong. It's just, it's not how it works.
It's funny that we know this intuitively. Your husband comes in with a knife and threatens you. That should be, you should be out of there, you know, pack up, leave. And yet a lot of people do stay in abusive relationships and abusive romantic relationships and abusive employment situations, because to your point before, the other guy, the husband with a knife, or the employer who's abusing the employee, or the citizen of a country who's taxing the shit out of them, thinks, they say, where are you going to go? Who else are you going to find? You know,
no one else will love you. No one will love you the way I love you.
It reminds me, and maybe I shouldn't say this on a podcast, but I've been known to mouth off before. There's a scene from Less Than Zero, which is a book by Bret Easton Ellis, where this kid, he's run up a big drug debt. And so this drug dealer has forced him to prostitute himself in order to pay off the drug debt. And it's like this, the pimp is, you know, he's not nice and he's slapping the kid around and injecting him with like intravenous drugs. I don't even remember which. The kid's name is Finn. He goes and he tries to say to the pimp a few times, this is terrible. My life is terrible. I'm, you know, a drug mule. I'm getting fucked all the time. Like, I don't like this. And the pimp is like, who's going to take care of you like I do? So I'm not comparing the United States government to a pimp trying to gaslight his prostitutes. But
I think there's a lot of gaslighting going on. I do.
There is. But I mean, sorry, go, Flory, go ahead.
Yeah, no, very simply. If you don't have freedom of choice, and by the way, Americans, I think, are some of the biggest people who deal with this, because they're an isolated country. Maybe Australia is the same way. They don't, it's not like, you know, if you live in Luxembourg, you just drive over to Belgium, you drive over to Germany one day. Like, there's this sense of like, there are other options. And I think, I don't know if it keeps the people in, keeps the politicians in check to some extent. I mean, obviously it hasn't entirely kept them in check. I mean, countries like France had like a 90% tax rate on certain kinds of income for a while, and people were moving to Belgium. Imagine moving to Belgium for tax relief. But they were. So in the US, in Australia, maybe to a certain extent in Canada, where you're kind of geographically isolated, people are not getting out into the world. You know, you don't cross over the border to buy groceries or to go shopping. You know, Spanish people drive to Andorra. Like, there's a feeling of options in Europe. As much as, you know, people say, oh, Europe also has taxes. Well, Europe has a number of tax incentives for foreigners. Many countries in Europe have that. They say, oh, it's not free. At least there's an awareness that there are other options. And being that those other options are sovereign countries, not just other states under the same federal government, I think that in a sense, even Europe perhaps would be a step up for many Americans. But they think, yes, France is rioting. Well, yeah, don't go to France. They don't have any of the things that I talked about. But, you know, could you go to an Ireland? Could you go to a Switzerland? Greece and Italy have opened up tax incentives. You know, a lot of people like countries like that. I was just in Italy. A lot of very wealthy Americans are moving there. And what you get for your buck is amazing. And there's more of kind of a laissez-faire approach. Not during COVID in Northern Italy, but I think in general, it's a bit more laid back in terms of enforcement. And by the way, that's what Americans don't see. You can call something, let's call it, just use your example, a lockdown. You can call that the same in different countries. I can tell you from experience, it's not. I think that Americans have this idea that they've looked at four other countries that you could take a cruise to. And, oh, those aren't any better. It's like, yeah, those aren't the ones we should be talking about. I watched this, someone sent me this Tucker Carlson interview. where he's talking about, oh, Andrew Tate lives in Romania, it's the average American, that's kind of this weird place, we can't find it on a map. And I realized I've been gone for so long that I've lost some touch with that perspective. To me, Romania is like pretty normal, pretty standard. I don't go to Romania very much, but like nothing bad, nothing good. Like it's just, it's pretty standard, right?
I mean, it's like, an option. For me, yeah, it's
yeah, like Tajikistan would be a little bit exotic for my flavor. Yeah. It's hard for me to entirely relate at this point, but I have to relate because we help people do this. And you've got to realize like that people want to go to the most common options, the most well-known options. And yet those aren't the ones that are going to help you. And so where are you going to go? Well, first of all, you've got to realize that Romania isn't really that bad and really isn't that much different. And any ways that it's different negatively probably makes up for it with different positively. Like, you know, beautiful women who are easier to get. I don't know. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was in 41 cities last year and I did this whole circuit tour of Europe. I spent a little bit of time in Eastern Europe. In Serbia and Croatia. And I loved it. I have very good friends in Serbia. I think that there is absolutely a sense for many Americans that there's like an out there, you know, we're here and then there's the rest and it's like all the same, but that's interesting that you point out Romania is, yeah, this is not that exotic. It's just a place. I think for a lot of Americans, it is. Nobody who grows up in New York, in the Bronx, you know, or Manhattan or Queens or wherever, thinks to themselves, what am I going to do this year? I'm going to move to Romania. You know, maybe they should.
New Yorkers moved to California, and I've known these guys for 20 years, or Arizona. They moved to Arizona, California. Hey, I'm out here. No, yeah. You're just here. You're here. Like, yeah, it's like where we're from is some epicenter. And listen, I was very fortunate in a sense to be born in a place like Cleveland, Ohio. People make fun of it. But you know what? Yes, many people stay there because it's my hometown. I like it. Okay. I like, you know, the pizza restaurant, whatever. But I don't think anyone is staying in Cleveland, Ohio because they think it's the epicenter of the universe. And I think probably we could have more attitudes like that.
I think. Okay, I mean, we don't. The case is ongoing. Perhaps don't comment on that. We shouldn't comment on this. I don't have maybe enough information to necessarily weigh in intelligently. But you used the example of Romania. I think what some people fear is that they're going to move somewhere else, whether it's Malaysia or Romania or Indonesia or wherever, and they're going to find if they do find themselves on the wrong side of the law somehow in some way that they will not be afforded some of the rights and liberties and, you know, how should I say civil rights, I guess, that you would be afforded in the United States or the United Kingdom or Canada. And so that's one concern for people. To use the example of Andrew Tate, there are a lot of people who would say that his legal treatment in Romania is kind of, you know, politicized in a bit of like a sham trial. So he is not representative of the average population. He's the most Googled man of 2022. That's not a normal person that invites so much public criticism.
I'm not a normal person, right? I mean, I gave up U.S. citizenship. I talk about it. I share my story. I want people to learn from my story. 9% of people, maybe I'm the only one who like is out there. There's a few others, I guess, who are openly, you know, talking about this. By the way, most people who talk about it once or twice. I talk about it continuously. So the idea that, I don't want to give up citizenship because maybe they're not going to like me. I think that probably, you know, I'm in a special category in that regard, to the extent, by the way, that if they follow, you know, the rules in some of these countries, the rules in a country with freedom of speech, aren't supposed to say, well, you said some unpleasant things that our country is going down in the economic rankings. So we don't want to let you. I mean, really? That's how it works? If that's how they feel about it, then maybe you don't want to go. I don't really know. I haven't followed the Andrew Tate trial extensively or know how the Romanian system works. It seems interesting. They put you in jail, then they put you on house arrest. In the U.S., a lot of people just sit in jail. And so I can tell you this, there's no country that I fear, just on an everyday basis, being out than the U.S. They had that book many years ago, Three Felonies a Day. I think they can make up whatever they want. I think this idea that if they want to, number one, the average person's not going to be in that crosshairs. And I would suggest that maybe the reason to go overseas is not to complain about your new country. People say, well, if I move to X country, they don't have as strong a freedom of speech and you can't protest. Why do you want to move to a country where you're going to plan to protest? Move to a country where you don't want to protest. And then kind of maybe be the expat who floats above it all. And kind of just let some of the political stuff go by. Maybe letting go of Joe Biden's a creep or Trump is terrible or whatever your politics are. Maybe let go of that because it's not making you happy.
I totally agree.
maybe you should just go somewhere and just kind of I read enough to know about what our business should know. I do not just sit around watching, politics. And so I just think that if there's any country that I just feel worse. You just drive around. I mean, I just saw this the other day. Was with a guy, and his assistant was driving the car. Gets pulled over for what we don't know. Has a friendly conversation. All right, you're not hurting anyone. All right, come on. Just slow it down a little bit or whatever. I mean, sometimes in the U.S., you watch some of those shows. I mean, they're body slamming you. They're taking. I just think that the U.S. has descended into being a total police state. I'm not saying other countries are perfect. I'm saying the idea that you're safe in the U.S. is, to me, nonsensical. And here's why you feel more safe. It's because it's what you know. If you spent a year living somewhere else, you would start to know that and you'd feel safe there as well.
I have done that and I've come to similar views. Not so much on the police state, I mean, to a certain degree on the policing. I mean, in the censorship and there's a lot of caveats. There's a lot of caveats. We have free speech, but we have due process, but you're safe except when the police you won't have issues with the police except asterisk.
Well, I mean, listen, but look at how the average person talks. And by the way, it's getting worse in the West. Gen Z, there's a study, 30% of Gen Z.
That's me, I think.
Thinks you should have cameras inside your house, surveillance cameras inside your house for the aforementioned abusive. Because listen, yes, it's your privacy. Someone will see you walking around naked. Who knows what the government workers will do with it? But hey, if it protects a few people from domestic violence, it's worth us all giving up our privacy.
No, just living it's not.
In Big Brother. That's the direction it's going. And I just think, I live in other countries. And yeah, if I do something heinous, they're going to come for me and it's not going to be pleasant. I mean, yes, the jails in Dubai or in Kuala Lumpur are probably not as comfortable as they are in Oslo. By the way, the jails in the U.S. are terrible. I mean, you read these reports.
They're awful. They're so bad.
Not from personal experience, but you just read these reports of he said this, he said that, some high profile defendant, he's sitting next to cockroaches. It's not great. But here's the problem. People are so emotional. I mean, there's people who say, I should be imprisoned because I tell people to leave the U.S. That should be just look in a YouTube comment section. Okay, these people, they have no basis in law, anything like that. That's fine. But that's what actual people think. These people get to vote in your society. Anyone who speaks up against the government, anyone who does this, they should be able to be it's a common thing. Someone should be imprisoned because they do something that you don't like. I go back to the earlier point. You're probably an idiot. But I mean, and I was just reading the other day about juries. And someone was talking about their experience in a jury. And we were looking it up. And it's a lot of these jurors are just all right, what do you all think? Let's get out of here. I mean, like when it comes down to it, you know, your experience is, you know, you've got to deal with a consul at the embassy, a guy who, you know, there's a guy who doesn't like me in that position, or, you know, you're going to deal with the police for something, or, you know, heaven forbid something goes wrong and 12 random people who just want to go out to lunch have to vote on your, here's the ultimate, that steals it for me is whenever like the public has an opinion on a trial and the jury doesn't vote the way that they like, suddenly the justice system is a sham.
Yep.
So I went to the
OGs. But only when they go against what you want.
Correct. Like, I mean, I don't know. I mean, okay, I was a kid when O.J. Simpson trial. I saw that come up on my feet again recently. And everyone's like, our justice system is a sham. Wait a second. Is it not a sham or is it a sham? And it's just like, you get the point that the average person in the West has had it so good for so long, and they don't realize there's countries now competing with them, and that's why their wages aren't going up. And so they're getting angrier and angrier because people like me are hiring in all other parts of the world, and they're no better for such a high price. And so like you just realize how emotional and how personal it is to them. The court system is not a sham as long as it always agrees with them, right? Some random guy, and it just shows you these institutions everyone holds dear. Mean nothing. They mean nothing really, because the average person only thinks they're great when it agrees with them, when it reinforces what they believe. And so at the end of the day, I was in Malaysia during the beginning of the pandemic. I walked around, I went to the grocery store, I did whatever. And I mean, zero interactions with anybody. You think that would have happened even in Florida? No, it didn't. Malaysia ended lockdowns before Florida did. But that goes against the narrative. It's so troublesome to see people who just think that the entire government of their country, of a world power, should be built around their image of how things work, and they don't even know the three branches of government. That's the country that's so great.
Yeah. Or could point out the state, even the different states on a map of their own country. It's really disconcerting, and it's really been something that I've thought about hard. I've lived in Jordan, I've lived in Australia and France, and you know, many other places. But when I left the United States for the first time as a young man, and I saw there are other ways of doing things, the way we organize ourselves as a society, the way we, as simple things like eating, the way we eat our meals with people, the times that we eat our meals. Our way is not the only way. But I think that a lot of people, there's this myopic, it's so great, it's so big, it's so this, it's so that. I mean, you use the example of, and you can absolutely be a patriot. I mean, you said this before, right? You said you can be a patriot, but say, you know what? I'm going to root for you guys from a distance. I hope America doesn't fall. I hope, but I'm not going to stick around, you know.
I'm not a patriot, but I'm happy to let people do what they want. I you know, if people don't agree with me, listen, 99% of people don't agree with me. They find it offensive. People will be triggered hearing these things. Why? What's been said? That my experience living in some other country has been more enjoyable, has been less anxiety inducing. I mean, first of all, that part's my opinion. Now I can replicate that across many other people. I can show you certain data. I can show you. But I mean, that alone triggers people so much.
Absolutely.
Because it just, they can't, I mean, here's what it is. I grew up in Cleveland. The sports teams are terrible. I think the Browns football team won like zero one year. They won zero games not that long ago. And yet people who I went to school with root for them. They go to the Browns. Guys, they're losers. They don't win.
Yeah.
But people, it's like, but you have to say, no, this is my team. I'm from this soil. Even though they like move the guys around, like, you know, this guy doesn't care about you. He'll be playing for some other team tomorrow. But like, this is my soil. And if you take that away from you, from these people, what do they have? This is why I define myself as an entrepreneur. Like, imagine you define yourself, I'm an American. Imagine even you define yourself as I'm a spouse. You don't control that.
Yeah.
Maybe your spouse gets sick of you one day. Like, so many people have to defend what sucks because perhaps it's all they really think they have. I don't think it's all they do have because they could create so much else. But it is their entire identity, and they have to be upset with you for just pointing out facts. It is a fact that the U.S. is less economically free compared to the rest of the world than it was when I was a kid. It's a fact. Everyone does studies. They, you know, scholars do this. It's a fact. And you're not going to fix it just because you don't like it.
What comes to mind here is that people are threatened when they see another person doing something differently from them. I faced this at a number of points in my life. I went to Princeton as an undergrad, worked really hard to get into Princeton, got there, really did not like it, had a lot of issues with it. I wrote a book in which I criticized a lot of aspects of the Princeton experience. And the Princeton students went fucking crazy. I mean, thousands of comments on Facebook, and I'm getting angry DMs and messages about this and that and what a terrible person I am, all these ad hominem attacks. When I was, you know, I said, look, you come here, it's an exercise in large part in leftist indoctrination, and then you're all hypocrites because most of you go and work in investment banks or management consultancies, despite being leftist. And the students got really angry. They said, no, that's not true. And I said, here's the data. I mean, it is true. It is true, first of all. And second of all, whether or not you like what I said or not, it's my opinion. My opinion is that the Princeton undergraduate experience is fundamentally broken. It's broken at many universities in America, particularly like elite universities that like toot themselves as being something that they are not. And I criticize students basically for being hypocritical. And first of all, in order to even get into these schools, you have to do 800 extracurricular. So you're pretending you're super interested in social justice and all of this, just to get in. And then once you get in, you're just going to go off and work at an investment bank anyway. And I said this and the students went crazy, despite not all of them. There was the whole cancellation attempt. There was a little scandal around this. And it was a time, at the time it hurt. I mean, people were making a lot of personal attacks. I was 21 or 22. I was 22 when the book came out. And what I came to realize later was basically that they're threatened. I left. I went to Australia. I finished my Princeton degree from Australia because there was COVID. I managed to eschew some of the lockdown craziness, but we had to leave. We had to like pack up our shit and leave every couple of weeks, every time they're going to do a lockdown. And I had a much better time in Australia than I did on campus. And then when I was telling people this, they're like, no. This is you don't speak for me. You don't. And I said, I don't claim to speak for you. I speak for myself. But frankly, I think this is representative of a lot of people's experience. And yet they turn. Or when I tell people I travel the world all the time, they say, oh, you must be, a diplomat, or you must be really rich, or you must be this. That's a constant one. Like, what are you so uncomfortable with about? What are you running from? Did you like commit some terrible crime? You know, some Grand Theft Auto, and you're on the run like fucking convict. It's people see you doing. They're working their job. Maybe they have a good job. They're making $80K a year, working for whoever, Procter and Gamble, and that's their life. They go to the gym. They see their friends for fucking Friday night drinks at whatever pub. They wake up, they do it again, they get a mortgage. That's their thing. They don't even conceive. And then they see me, you know, they see Instagram stories or whatever. And what does an Instagram story even tell? Like a tiny little sliver of, you know, the reality of whatever the situation is. Oh, I wish people say, I wish I could, I wish I could do what you're doing.
I think they don't know. I think they don't know. In a sense, they wish. In a sense, it's a jealousy. Like, listen, I think that the ultimate thing, I look at it and I examine it for the purpose of understanding clients and understanding how to serve them and understanding, you know, the common issues. One thing I continually tell our team when we serve people is we keep thinking because they're successful people, and because oftentimes they've read a few things and say, hey, listen, I know a lot about this stuff, that we think that they're like in university level. Really, people are in preschool level. I helped a friend get a second passport. He wasn't sure which to use where when he was traveling somewhere. And so, like, most people don't know how this stuff works.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I have multiple citizenships by investment is one of the ways where I get citizenship. I mean, the background check on those, they dig into everything. And so, you know, people still say, oh, I'm running from something in the sense of like, what do you try to avoid? And listen, it's true. I was bullied for 9 out of 13 years as a kid. And yeah, there's a part of me that just associates, I don't like the politics of the US, but part of it's just like, I don't think I get along with people as an entrepreneur who, you know, just all the experiences I had, and I'm a fast paced guy. And even as an adult, it was just, you know, wasn't comfortable for me at a social level. And so when I want to leave that, then it's like, oh, now I'm the bad guy, according to the console.
Because you're doing something different from them. That's why they're the bad guy, because you threaten their comfort and security and their level of whatever by doing something simply by virtue of deviating. You're a threat to them, you know?
Well, deviation is generally from anything. Yeah, it's a threat. And but my point was, going out, I look at this stuff enough to try and understand the people that we serve, whether it's our clients, whether it's people who come to our live event. I think mindset and the way you look at this stuff is important. People's eyes roll. You get fewer views on those YouTube videos. But to me, that's the value that I can add for someone. Yes, we can figure out how your U.S. taxes mix with this and with that. And that's important. But if you never take the first step, or if you take the first step and then you back out of it too quickly because you didn't know what you're doing and you got uncomfortable, that's the biggest issue. And so I don't pay attention too much. I think this is what every entrepreneur and successful person has to do. I've really tried to not pay attention to everyone who's got a beef, because everyone's gunning for you once you're successful. And you know, if you listen to everybody and their flawed logic, I mean, just some of the people that you hear from, totally baseless in logic, doesn't make any sense at all. But that's, listen, they get to have a voice. And so you need to just not listen to it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think being able to shut out the chatter is key, which brings me to my next line of questions, which is about mindset. Because I do, reading your book, it, first of all, it's a great book. So thank you for writing it. I think you're doing important work. And I think that the mindset beyond, you know, passports and relocation and whatever, I think if nothing else, the people listening to this will get a lot from mindset. So there's a few like heuristics that you mentioned in the book that resonated with me that I, you know, like to talk about with you. Number one, shuttles are for slaves. Let's discuss.
Well, that was a first long, of all, yeah. It wasn't my comment. That was a comment.
No, I am partial to this. You know, it's like, do you want to give the backstory, or I can? Or
well, very simply, we had an event in Las Vegas. We have we used to have a number of live events. We've brought it back now. It's Nomad Capitalist Live. We get hundreds of people in the room, and we teach the stuff that we teach. And I think even more than what we teach, it's a great networking opportunity, and people meet like-minded people. And they realize they're not alone. But we had one of these about a decade ago now. And we had the very first one in Las Vegas. I'm sure I get more people if they were in Las Vegas, but I'm trying to get people out of their comfort zone. And we do them overseas now. We're doing this VIP dinner. And the guy who's organizing the event comes around like, okay, it's the last shuttle. We're at the Palms Hotel. You want to go back to whatever your hotel is. The last shuttle's coming around. And one of these speakers just looks and says, shuttles are for slaves. It's just this kind of avant-garde response, I suppose, that guy would have. But, you know, for him, it's like, I want the freedom to do what I want and to go where I want when I want. And like, I'm not going to be on someone else's timetable. Now, listen, I was just in Europe. I'll occasionally take a train. I'm not opposed to taking a train. But I think there's some logic in saying, You know, if you're the person sitting at the dinner at the Palms and, hey, it's the last shuttle. Oh, my God, we got to hurry up. It's like, wait a second. No, you can pay $12 and you can get a taxi. You could walk, get some fresh air. You know, there's a lot of things you could do. But we're all trained like, oh, my God, it's the last shuttle. Okay, hurry, hurry. And we do these, you know, inorganic behaviors.
Yeah, that's a good inorganic just because that's what you just do the thing to do because that's what's always been done. Or like that's what the rule is.
Or there's
a
social pressure or just kind of this implied like, well, hey, when someone says it's the last, what are you, well, you know, you got to hurry up and get on that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very partial to this is you don't, nothing is written in the stars. You don't have to do something like it. Nothing is, that wasn't the right phrase. That's more about destiny, but you're not forced to do anything. It's like, I have to get up at this time and I have to do this and I have to do that and I have to do that. No, like not do whatever you want. You should be like a responsible human and be producing things. But you don't have to take the shuttle just because that's when the last shuttle is leaving. There's many other modes of transportation that can get you home in the same way that in every other aspect of life, you don't have to do the thing that you're supposed to do or that everyone else is doing just because that's the way it is. So I'm partial to that. Okay, my next thing is on boundaries and zero tolerance. I think I saw a reel maybe you talking about this, and I think it's important. There was a guy who came on before you onto this show named Sahil Bloom. He's a writer. He sends out this newsletter called The Curiosity Chronicle. It's great. I like it a lot. We had an interesting conversation. One of the things this guy talks about is black holes and boat anchors. And he says some people in your life are boat anchors. They're inhibiting the boat from moving forward, from doing what a boat does, you know, run. And then other people, black hole, like events, people, cities, places, whatever, that suck out all the luck. You know, he's like, expand your surface area of luck. If you're hanging out with guys who are just smoking weed all the time, what are you probably going to be doing smoking weed all the time? If you're hanging out, if you're trying to go to the gym, you should be hanging out with people who also incorporate fitness into their daily life, you know? So I don't know. I liked this zero tolerance thing. It's hard for people. Oh, but they're my friend, but they're my cousin. In a lot of cases, it's family. It's my brother. I can't abandon my brother. I can't abandon my sister, my, you know, or parents, whatever. But Alex Hormozi, I like. He has all this stuff on why I chose to disappoint my father. But
I think he's
talk to me.
Trailblazer. Yeah.
Who? Hormozi?
I like that there's stuff that I've thought. I'm like, is this worth talking about? And he's like, all right. Then he talks about it. Yeah. I like that. Well, no, I just think you have to have boundaries for yourself in life. I look at myself in my life, in my business. You know, there's a lot of shame that comes into it. Even there are people, I mean, I was just talking to our operations manager. He said about 97% of people this year who've worked with us, it's a 4 or 5 star experience, with about 80% of those being 5 star. But that still leaves a handful of people. He says there's no 2 or 3 star. The others, they just hate you. And, you know, sometimes we make mistakes. But I think also a lot of it is just like there's an emotion around doing this stuff that scares people. And me included react, you know, negatively when like a bank doesn't want to open an account for you or something like that, even though we might have known that that bank was a 50-50 chance. And there's a thing like, oh, here's what you should do. Look at how the government, you know, talks. Here's what you should do. Look at how people in your life. Oh, here's what you should do. I got the best permission slip from my parents. And as I said, I didn't have a perfect childhood, but I got this great permission slip that you don't have to stick around and take care of us. You should go where you're treated best. And I think a lot of kids don't get that. And they're told out of shame, like, how are we going to take care of ourselves when we're old? You have to sacrifice your dreams and your opportunities. And I just think that a lot of people need to put up defenses against shame. It's that simple.
But it's not that simple. It's really hard for a lot of people.
It's very hard to do the thing, absolutely, to do that, yeah. It is. And you know, it's not supposed to sound like, you know, some of these people maybe that you went to Princeton with, I don't know, just the shorthand that comes into my mind, where you're getting people's face and like, you know, this is violence. It's, you know,
crazy. You
know, right. Yeah. But I'm just saying, listen, here's what I'm willing to accept. And I think, you know, what I'm cognizant of is that in my circles, there are certainly people who I think, somebody told me once, there's some people that you work with, there's some people that are in your ecosystem, maybe they're viewers, whatever, who they don't want to go where they're treated best. They want to go where their toxicity is tolerated. That's not the goal here, right? There are certainly people who they feel
bad.
What
does that mean?
Well, they want to. Well,
not metaphorically, literally. What do you mean where their toxicity is tolerated?
Well, I think there are people who figure, hey, if I go to some other country, then I can be a Karen. And they'll accept that more there. So I think like certain Westerners go to Asia, and because of the Asian concept of saving face, like they're not going to get in your face and like argue with you, like, you know, like you're wrong. They're just going to like kind of take it. But you're not going to get your problem solved. So it's a small number of people, but I see it where, you know, you have to say, what is it I believe? What is it I accept? What is it I tolerate? And just set boundaries around that. I mean, not something I'm very good at by default, and so I've had to learn it. But again, I go back to what am I? I'm an entrepreneur. And I think entrepreneurship to me is constant growth mentality. And so you want to solve something, solve it. You know, figure out what it takes to do and do it.
What are some things you don't tolerate?
The one word that really is becoming important for me in everything from country selection to personal relationships is kindness. I think it's an important attribute and something to strive for. And so I say, you're not running from something, you're running to something. And if I look back at defining really one of the bigger parts of my leaving the US, yes, I thought taxes were way too high. And when I figured out I can pay less of them by living overseas, that was certainly attractive. But I think one of the big things was, I don't feel that who I am, it can be treated kindly. And there's probably when I was younger, some weird ways I responded to not being, feel like I was treated kindly. But I remember, I think at my core, I'm a pretty kind person who wants to help other people and watch other people grow and share the wealth and all that. And I think that's kind of been an unstated part of my journey for many years. So now it's something that is stated part, and I'm looking for it. And so, you know, the difficult part has been saying, like, there's really no excuse to not have that. I mean, when someone threatens to burn down your office building because you didn't accept them as a client, like, that's kind of an extreme version of not kindness. But even in that extreme version, the people are just like, you owe me a response. And so I think that kindness is, you know, no one's owed anything. You're going to be treated based on, you know, how you treat people. And listen, there's people who don't like me or don't like my organization. And that's fine. And I think that what we need to have more of as a society is this idea that, like, we can reject certain things from our life or our business without it being some great personal affront, right? We don't accept certain people as clients in our business. Mostly, most of the time, it's just they don't have enough wealth. and our services wouldn't be, you know, they'd spend too much money to solve a problem, you know, at a level that they don't have it. And I don't want to do that. Even if they would pay it, I just don't feel comfortable taking someone's money, you know, for them to get a 5-year return on investment. For me, that's a form of kindness, and not everyone agrees. They say, oh, how dare you? Why are you exclusionary? I don't know why it has to be where we're at each other's throats. Mm-hmm. You know, people don't get a job at a company. Listen, it's not a fit. Someone doesn't want to go out with you on a date. It's not a fit. This idea that like everything should be an attack that has to be pushed back.
Yeah.
I think just getting closer to kindness and accepting we're all on this journey and we're all going to different places. But I think a lot of people practice that for themselves. They want that for themselves. But I think you have to practice it from your own perspective as well.
Everything you just said, I agree with and resonates. Absolutely. Most especially the kindness bit. I have found a level of hospitality and warmth and genuine interest in other people. Not interest in what can you do for me or how can you be professionally beneficial to me, but a genuine level of warmth and hospitality and kindness in other countries that I have experienced to a much lesser degree in the United States, in different places of the United States. But even in Helsinki, you know, I didn't have a place to say, oh, you can stay in my apartment. Okay. She says, yeah, I'll stay with my boyfriend for a week. Have my apartment. Okay. So I'm staying in Pietarjoki, right outside of Helsinki. You have my friend's apartment. And in Australia, there is a little bit of fakeness, like Southern hospitality that's not that hospitable going on. But I mean, on the whole, in general, I've found people to take a real genuine interest in you in a way that Americans, again, painting with a broad brush, in a way that has not necessarily been as common of my experience in the United States.
I think my experience, my wife pointed out to me, I think Malaysia and that part of the world probably is superior for me in terms of genuine kindness. I think maybe some of the, maybe even some of the Arabic countries to some extent have this. But what I like, I mean, I don't think that like in Malaysia, people overthink things, which I think is a big thing for being happy. There was a great book like when I started this journey 12, 15 years ago that came out, The Geography of Bliss. Hmm. And everyone says, oh, Denmark is the happiest country in the world. You know, all these lists come out. They're always so Western-centric. What are the most livable cities? You might see Singapore on there, but you never see, I mean, I think Kuala Lumpur is one of the most livable cities when you take into account that people are worried about stretching their dollars these days. And you get a lot more bang for your buck. And people are kind. And you have all the amenities that you'd have anywhere else, I guess, except Amazon. I don't know why why the cities lists are so Western centric. I don't understand why like the happiness indexes are so Western centric. Like I've been to Denmark. It just seems like another Western country. Maybe they're marginally happier. But to me, you look at a Malaysia, you look at a Philippines, you look at places where people just have a different approach on life. Mm. I mean, someone once told me that the average Malay in Malaysia, they said, listen, their ambition is they want to have nasi lemak for lunch. They want to buy a motorcycle. Maybe then they'll buy a perodua. Like someone was explaining, this is kind of, for some of us, our culture. We don't have these great ambitions to always be replacing, you know, to getting the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. We have a happiness. You know, Malaysia, their thing is they like eating. A lot of things are based, right? You know, again, we're having our live event there. I'm like, we don't need 5 snack breaks. All right.
Yeah.
But like, so they enjoy just the eating and enjoying food and enjoying it with other people and having conversation. And obviously, you know, you and I have chosen to live a little bit differently than that. But I think that you find people who are genuinely happy, and that's where kindness comes from. And so I think that for me, the thing has been resetting to see the positivity in everything that you do as an entrepreneur, strip out the negativity, deploy empathy towards people, which is not always easy, who don't understand, and go on with your life knowing that you're doing the right thing. And I think that gets you to much at the same point. But yeah, I think that people in the U.S., there's a lot of neurosis. That just, it's a very unique culture. I mean, every day there's a shooting. I mean, there's something not, and it's sad. There's something not well there that I think is unique to the U.S.
I think, well, I mean, you think we hear about those. I think the sample size in the United States is larger. It's a massive country, 330 million people. So very low probability events are more likely to happen, even if extremely infrequently. And I think that there's also a spotlight put on. I mean, people are shot all around the world every day, but you don't hear about some guy getting shot in Juarez because it's just a fixture. You know, so if the same number of people were shot in Juarez and were shot in the south side of Chicago every day, and I'm not saying that that's an accurate, you know, whatever, but if this is to say in one day the same number of people are shot, neither one is going to get as much news coverage as somebody shot in Times Square, because it doesn't happen in Times Square, you know, but it does happen all the time, the south side of Chicago and in Juarez. So, you know.
And I've argued that there's certainly cities in Latin America that are safer than cities in the United States. But with Latin America being probably among the least. I mean, the Americas are the least safe continents.
Yeah, but I agree. I mean, you said this before, too. If you're an American, you're not fucking moving to Juarez. You're going to move to Mexico City or to Oaxaca or to Zihuatanejo or something.
We're going to move to the good neighborhood.
Yeah, you're not going to like the most dangerous part of the country. You wouldn't do that in America either. You wouldn't do that in your own city.
I got criticized for like, oh, he just moves to like the rich areas, and that's why like he can say this city is safe. And again, I go back to being an entrepreneur. One of the benefits of working hard and sacrificing and, you know, being shrewd, hopefully, and accumulating some wealth is, yeah, like we all want safety. It's easier to be an entrepreneur than ever before, maybe not mentally, but I mean, we have clients who are 24 years old and living in Morocco who have built multi-million dollar e-commerce companies, and we can be done. Those guys didn't have those opportunities 20 years ago. So, you know, my view in the world is dictated by the fact that, yeah, I'm not moving to the worst part of Bogota. I'm moving to a generally safe part of Bogota.
Yeah.
And again, in the same way that I, you know, wouldn't live in an unsafe part of the U.S. if I were to still live there. I would live in a nice part of the city. And some reason people, they think that like, you know, everyone in Mexico City is being kidnapped. No, there's beautiful areas. And there are certain things, again, in the Americas that you should do. I've talked to some very wealthy people in Mexico. One of them had some very nice cars. The rest drive very basic cars. They don't want to be a target. So there is that adjustment. If you want to drive a fancy car, you go to Dubai, you go to Asia, you go to Europe. Obviously, in Europe, maybe people wouldn't like you for other reasons in some of the countries. But I mean, there are people living your equivalent lifestyle. And it was just so funny talking to Mexican clients who live in the suburbs of various, you know, Guadalajara, Mexico City. It sounds very much like the same things that someone living in an upscale suburb of Chicago would be talking about.
I think when you watch movies that turn to sepia, you don't get that opinion. But the people are not that different from you. You know, they're really not, except on some of the mentality stuff. And again, you know, broad brush, I'm not saying all Americans is all Americans that, but one thing, and you've alluded to this on the cars, is important. I see guys, you know, the car, this idea of like car payments, you know, and then like you're leasing this car because you want to get a new SUV, because you want to get this, and you get a promotion. First thing you do, you go buy a new car. First of all, that's not how you build wealth, but beyond the obvious, I see a lot of these metrics of success, conventional success in America, is marred in vanity, you know, like the metrics of a house when I get a mortgage, the metrics of I want to upgrade my house every however many years. I want to upgrade my car. I want to upgrade my wardrobe. I want to upgrade. You know, you always want the premium option only in America. And I was listening to this great podcast with Pete Holmes and Michael Schur, but only in America, or maybe not only, certainly in Dubai, this would be the case, but there's always like the standard version and the pro version, or the diamond version, or diamond elite, diamond platinum, you know, Amex platinum, I think people in the United States are constantly, let me go back to the Malaysia example. You want to have a motorcycle, you want to have food, whatever. I think in terms of what fulfills you and makes you happy, you don't need that much stuff. Like, I live out of a little carry-on suitcase, and I'm not saying that that's the right way or the only way or enough for most people. But for me, I don't need a lot of stuff. Like, I want to be light on my feet, be able to travel. I don't know. I look at the car payments and the house payments and people just upgrading shit that they don't need and buying stuff they can't even afford to impress their friends or to fulfill what, you know? I don't know.
I do think consumer credit's becoming a bit, even in kind of historically saving focused China, I think consumer credit's being a bigger thing, which is unfortunate. I did a class for all of our employees who wanted to come about just basic money management, kind of like Dave Ramsey level stuff.
Yeah.
Because I realized, and this is a key realization, like I thought, okay, what I learned, I was never given any money, but I grew up in a family that was, you know, not loaded, but you know, was successful.
Sure.
And I learned about how to manage money, how to waste money, how to save, how to invest, like delayed gratification. Like that was what I took away from that, not actual cash, but something worth much more than cash. And so I taught them, you know, what to do. And I'm like, don't get into debt. I have no debt. I'm not one of these guys. Oh, if you want to build a big business, you need all the rich guys have debt. That's not true. You are seeing more debt in other countries. Certainly there is keeping up with the Joneses. You know, I went to Asia and I kind of got into, oh, you know, are you wearing the Gucci sneakers? And fashion was always a thing that I liked. I like, you know, nice clothes. I don't necessarily need, if I'm living in the city center, I don't want a car. So I think what you get to do when you're living the nomad capitalist life is you get to define for yourself what the luxuries are. And if you want to buy $1,000 shoes, go ahead. I never saw if I had a car, it would be a nice car. But I'd rather have, you know, cashmere sweaters that are comfortable than, you know, drive a sports car.
Yeah.
And so I think you get to define those things. And so therefore, I'm not keeping up with the Joneses. I'm just buying the stuff that I would like. Listen, there are people who will tell you not to spend money on stuff that you enjoy because, oh, you're getting too uppity. Right. Oh, you know, why do you need that? You know, why do you need so many pairs of shoes? I mean, so I think that there's always pressures on both sides. I think that what, you know, escaping, you know, the matrix, whatever you want to call it,
yeah,
gives you permission. It just opens up the mind. Okay, what do I want to put back in here?
Yeah.
I think people are flashing everywhere in the world. There's some code everywhere. There's a great book 15 years ago, the $10 trillion prize about China and India's ascent. I think India is a very interesting place. I invest in India. But it talks about how, like, what do those cultures view as important? Like, there's certain things they cheap out on, and there's certain things they spend a lot of money on to as a social signal. I think that's the same everywhere. But I think that in some cases, you know, these cultures are moving in the right direction, whereas others, like in the West, are moving in the wrong direction.
Mm.
Maybe they should flaunt it a little bit in some of these countries, because that's proof that they're going up.
I mean, I think there are signals everywhere. Absolutely. I forget who even said this quote, but it's like we buy things we don't want with money we don't have to impress people we don't like. And I think you're right that the breaking out of the matrix, you know, taking it doesn't suddenly give you the answers. It gives you options. Then you can decide for yourself what's important. If you want the $1,000 Gucci sneakers, that's fine. There's nothing shameful about that inherently. What would be, shame isn't the right word. What would be wrong is simply wearing these uncomfortable sneakers that you don't like simply because you know that the other people are going to like them.
So everyone's just doing it. This is why my wife was a good fit for me, because I met women who, seemingly had everything else going for them, but they were from, let's say, a smaller country. And it's like, oh, well, I don't want to go to Malaysia because in the winter we have to go to this ski resort. And like, that's the place where all the other people from the country, like, I have to be seen there or else I'm going to be a nobody. And in the summer we have to go to like this beach in July. Like, they all go there. So if you're making decisions based on that, then that to me is when you've got a problem. If it's just, hey, I want to go to Saint-Tropez because I like Saint-Tropez. I mean, all right, great. Then that's what you're doing. And quite frankly, every successful person almost that I've met is like, where are people not going? That's where I want to go. I don't want to be like in a mass of humanity just because it's supposed to be cool.
Yeah. That's funny. I was in Colorado once, and I was in Aspen, and it like someone made a joke. I said, "Who's here?" And they said, "New Yorkers." That's where they come. The Manhattan housewife and their, whatever the families, they relocate to Aspen for whatever 2 weeks a year and they go back. It's like, we're all going to go together en masse, like a flock of fucking geese. That's a telling thing. I need to go to this ski resort. I need to go to this or that. Like, that's, I don't find that to be, it's not a value that I share. Like that type of signaling, like signaling without thought. If you really like going there, that's one thing. But a lot of people, they don't even ski. They just go. I was a competitive ski racer. And the amount of these, I was in Utah this year for a conference. And there was like 2 days they skied at Deer Valley. And it's this fancy ski resort. Where there's like no snowboarders. And it wasn't my favorite. It was too fancy for my liking. But there were all these fur, someone called them fur collar skiers, who are fucking bad skiers. And I'm like former racer. I have double blacks like tattooed on my arm. And I was just thinking, these people aren't here to ski. This is, get the fuck off the mountain. I'm here to ski, Anyway, whatever. We're coming up on the time. I want to be, respectful of your time. We said this would be 90 minutes. So I want to get through a few last minute questions, if that's all right.
Mm.
Okay. Number one, this idea that politicians won't save you. We're like going back to what we were discussing before, but I think it's important. People are so passionate about the next election, right? They're so passionate about this politician, that the politicians become celebrities going to the fucking Met Gala and they're on TikTok and this. Politicians are not going to solve your problems for you. Zuby, Zuby's coming to the thing in Malaysia. Zuby, one of his big things, he came on the and we're going to talk about that conference is my last question. But Zuby's on a podcast and he's talking all about personal responsibility. And I'm just like, yes, take responsibility for what's in your life. Take complete responsibility. Don't outsource it to some fucking politician. Say, oh, the world's ending because Trump or because Biden or because this or that. The average life of normal everyday people does not really change based on who's in office
countries. And it upsets me that Trump gets out. I was a libertarian, so I was conservative on a number of issues. But it's like, oh, Trump is out of office. And within 2 weeks, the country has fallen to shambles. Really? A country of 330 million people falls to shambles in 2 weeks? Or if he gets back in within 2 weeks, it'll be the greatest country in the world again. Finally. I mean, like, it feels nice, maybe. They may say you can do this or you can do that or you can't do that now. Fine. Like, there are some actual things that they change. Whether that should be how it works or not is another discussion. But generally speaking, if you're an entrepreneur, if you're a successful person, if you're charting your own destiny, the best thing these people can do for you is just get out of your way. And I think that's what threatens some of them, all of them, I don't know, for me, there's already a place that exists that is what you want. And if you compartmentalize your life and you say, okay, well, I'd like my money to be safe, that may not be the same place where you enjoy living. So you can compartmentalize those now. And you can say, okay, I don't have to settle. Why are you settling? I mean, we live in a time of great choice and optionality for people to have to be settling, like it's the 1800s or something. But politicians are not going to save you. They're probably going to make your life more difficult. They're going to create more anxiety. They're going to create more friction. And this idea, you know, I spent close to 10 years, running a business adjacent to the talk radio space. And I would go and meet Laura Ingraham and Bill O'Reilly and Dennis Miller and all these, you know, people and they at their shows. And it's just the audience just thinks that, like, if you vote for the right person, everything is solved. And it's about a culture. The culture is what dictates, and the culture in the West has been going in the wrong direction for probably 50 years. It's not a social commentary. It's a commentary on how we treat innovation, entrepreneurship, success, and what we think we're entitled to from things we didn't earn.
Okay. Do we have time for two more last minute questions? Yeah. This one is from one of the guys who works for me. He's a nice kid. He's an undergrad. And he wanted me to ask this, so I'm going to ask it. And I think it's a good question. His question is, what are the best ways for students or young professionals who have not yet accumulated enough capital for serious real estate investment, complex corporate structures, or golden visa type expeditions to begin the process of diversifying their citizenship and banking?
Well, on the banking piece, you can get a bank account somewhere for a dollar in a country like Georgia. There are fewer and fewer of those. They're going away. They're shutting down to only residents, or they're raising the bar, like in Singapore, for example. It used to be 1,000. Now it's hundreds of thousands. So if you want to, you know, create what I call a banking tunnel, that's one thing you can do. The other thing you can do is you can travel. You can find your place. You can find where it is that, you know, you'd like to be. Most places are going to be less expensive than the U.S. I have this weird dichotomy that, you know, we talk about building successful businesses, and then I live in places that, generally speaking, are less expensive than the U.S. I do spend some time in Ireland now, which is, I would say, as expensive as the U.S. But you can go to places that are much more affordable. I'd say right now those are in places that are non-dollar-based economies in Latin America or Asia. So like Malaysia, in many cases, is going to be cheaper than Cambodia, because Cambodia is in the dollar. And so the currency fluctuations in Malaysia actually make it more affordable. Plus, you have more of a domestic economy there. A place like Colombia, for example, or Argentina, if you play it correctly,
would be better. Loved Argentina.
So, I mean, it's just exploring. It's setting up whatever tunnels you can. I mean, I still have a bank account in Singapore. It was $1,000 Singapore dollar requirement back in like over a decade ago. They no longer offer that, but I'm grandfathered in. So if you can find things like that, like I mentioned in Georgia, that'll work. And then either figure out, you know, am I going to make my money remotely? Am I going to start some kind of business online or that I can do online? I don't, not everything should be a Shopify store. Something should be consulting or services or whatever, but just it's performed from wherever you are. Or am I going to do something on the ground? I mean, there's people who, you know, very simple businesses in emerging and frontier markets. They open an ice cream parlor. I mean, in Cambodia for years, I think it's more competitive now, but brown coffee was unstoppable. Starbucks was afraid of coming into Cambodia because they dominated it. It's like three guys who started a coffee shop and they just took over because there were really no coffee shops. So, you know, you could look at doing something like that where you could build a really great business, or you're going to build something that travels with you no matter where you go. The solution for everything is, you know, have some more funds. And so I would ask myself, you know, what do I need to do and what do I not need to do to get to where I want to be? You know, getting master's degrees and PhDs probably isn't it. you know, I do think this don't go to college thing. Maybe I'm just too uncomfortable because a lot of people are saying it now. Sounds like a Trumpian thing. A lot of people are saying it. But
I'm more or less on board with that. From my perch. But I'm.
It's probably worse than ever going to college. Although, if you are going to go to college, if you're in the U.S., maybe you consider going somewhere in Europe much more inexpensively.
And oh, yes.
I think it's less about the college experience there, I think, is what my European friends tell me.
Yeah, you can recreate some of it in Europe. I mean, I was at a university in Prague last year, and it was anyway.
Listen, if you're an intelligent person, you'll meet more girls in outside the U.S. at 18.
It's Larry Benefit. But okay, last question here. Tell us about this conference, Nomad Capitalist Live.
Yeah, so. We work with, you know, high net worth individuals in our business. And obviously, you know, with like 2,400 YouTube videos and these interviews and everything we do, I mean, we get a lot of people who they're not millionaires, as your guy was asking. So we put together an event. There's no sponsors at our event. It's just nothing but information for 4 days. This is the third one in the current incarnation. We're doing it in Kuala Lumpur, in Malaysia, because I've lived there part-time for close to a decade, and I wanted to share it with people. So we're at a beautiful hotel, Colonial Hotel in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and it's September 6th through 9th. I won't bear the lead. It's September 6th through the 9th this year, Kuala Lumpur, 4 days of how to open a bank account overseas, how to open a brokerage account, how to open a foreign company, how does it affect your taxes? How do you do proper tax planning? What are the common misconceptions? How do you get a second residence? How do you get a second passport? How do you claim citizenship through your ancestors? If you're a business owner, how do you get citizenship through things for business owners? How do you diversify your assets? Where's the best real estate? We've got some great speakers. We've got guys who are doing investments in Thailand and Cambodia, who are doing investments all over Latin America. We've got our team who heads up all of our client efforts. Plus, we've got Jim Rogers is coming, the adventure capitalist. He's speaking. Yeah. I read his book 25 years ago. Zuby, you mentioned, talks about, you know, interesting places to live that are kind of unmatrix-like, again, to use their phraseology. We've got Mark Faber, legendary investor. We've got a whole ton of people who are coming. My father, who gave this ultimate permission slip and said, go where you're treated best. The U.S. will not be what it is today in 25 years. He talks, the Nomad Dad. So it's just kind of a 4-day compendium of nonstop information, but also a little bit of mindset, also a little bit of challenges, because I don't want people to think, oh, it's just so easy. It's taken me 15 years to get to where I am today. I could get you there in a year or two, perhaps, for most of it. But it wasn't easy. There's a lot of, you know, nooks and crannies and, you know, misconceptions. So it's nonstop of that. Plus a lot of great food, a lot of great people. It's Nomad Capitalist Live, and it's just nomadcapitalist.com/live. You can just read all about it. We do one event every year.
Great. I have to look at my fall calendar, but maybe I'll be there and we can shake hands in person.
September 6th through 9th. Yeah, I would love to do it.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on to the show, Andrew.
My pleasure.